And welcome back to Open Line. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Fred Anderle on WOSU. This hour, we look at the economy of the Midwest and the age of globalization. For 60 years, the Midwest drove the nation and a large portion of the world's economy. For the first half, mainly, of the 20th century, the Midwest was the Silicon Valley of its day. Ford, Goodyear, Delco, Maytag, they were the Microsoft, Intel, and Google of their day. Innovative engineers and business people developed new products and new processes that revolutionized manufacturing. The age made fortunes for company owners, and it made for very good livings for millions of Midwest workers. Also during this time, the Midwest's agriculture business was booming as well. But then the rest of the world caught up, and the Midwest manufacturing lost much of its innovative edge, and it's now shedding workers to automation and also to the South and to Mexico and Asia. Farming has also suffered under global competition. For a look at what happened, we turn to Richard Longworth. He's a former Chicago Tribune writer and now a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. His new book is Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. Richard, welcome to Open Line.
Mike, good morning to you. How are you?
Good, thanks. I read one review, one reviewer who praised you for realizing that the world is flat before Thomas Friedman did, globalization was catching up with the Midwest, or at least the Midwest was flat when you wrote your first book.
Yes, we had one of the first books out there at about the same time as Tom wrote his original book on the Lexus and the Olive Tree.
What started the beginning? It's a good place to start, as always. But we've all heard the stories lately about, you know, manufacturing shutdowns, factory shutdowns, and worker layoffs, and auto plants going dark and moving out of the area and things like that. But let's go back to when the Midwest was starting to boom. Why did the Midwest boom, and what were the roots of its success back at the beginning of the 20th century?
The roots of the success back in the early 20th century were a lot of things we know about. We had iron and steel. We had good railroads. We had a lot of workers pouring into the region from mostly from Europe. But basically, Mike, what we had was ideas. You mentioned earlier that the Midwest was the Silicon Valley of the early 20th century. You know, it's a little hard to imagine that now. But all these guys that you mentioned, Olds and Timken and Goodrich and Ford, these were the backyard tinkerers of their day. These were the smart guys in basements and garages who risked it all. We had an entrepreneurial mentality. We had a risk-taking mentality that we seem to have lost. We had an innovative mentality. And from these ideas grew these terrific companies and corporations that have powered the Midwestern economy. You know, they powered the American economy, to some degree the world economy, for most of the 20th century. And we had so many really, really good ideas that we didn't have to come up with any new ones. These corporations employed our workforces. They paid for the business schools that turned out business people, managers who knew how to manage old companies, now start new ones. They paid the taxes for our cities and our counties and our states. They did such a great job that we didn't have to come up with any new ideas. And somewhere along the line, we lost the knack. We lost this innovative spirit. And to a great degree, our challenge for the future is trying to figure out how to get it back.
292-8513, 292-8513, or you can email us at openline@wosu.org if you have a question or a comment for Richard Longworth. He is the author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalization. He traveled the Midwest, went from town to town, city to city, and tried to find out what went wrong. Why did manufacturing, why did the Midwest go from boom to bust in the latter part of the 20th century. 292-8513, 292-8513 to take part in Open Line. Richard, agribusiness also was booming in the first part of the 1900s.
Well, agribusiness is still booming, and Mike, to an odd degree, a lot of manufacturing is still booming. We manufacture here more in the Midwest than we ever did. Our manufacturing exports are up. Our farms are booming. They're turning out the crops. You know, climate and land isn't going to go away. We're still going to be able to do this. But at the same time, the ability of these farms and the ability of manufacturing factories to support our economies, to support our civilizations, really, has dwindled. If manufacturing and manufacturing exports are way up, manufacturing jobs are way down. Pretty much what's left of the American steel industry has imploded to, you know, I can see it from my office window, northwestern Indiana, where they turn out more steel than they ever did, but they do it with about one-tenth as many workers. Farms still turn out as much, but about 2% of the population of the Midwest is actually engaged in farming, and of that, only a really small percent produces most of the food. These are the big farmers. You've got old factories that are still turning it out, but you've got manufacturing towns in Ohio and Indiana and Illinois, even in Iowa and Michigan, that are dying. These are the Flints, these are the Andersons and Muncies. The Columbus Dispatch had a terrific series of articles, and they pointed out that of Ohio's seven biggest cities, six have lost two-thirds of their manufacturing jobs and also have lost more than half their population. Now, there's a school of thought that says you lose more than half your people, turn out the lights, your city isn't coming back. We don't know if that's true, but it's an alarm, big alarm for Ohio and for the other manufacturing states of the Midwest.
292-8513 to join the conversation here on Open Line on WOSU. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Fred Anderle. You mentioned Dayton, more patents per capita than any city. The city gave birth to things, the cash register, the microfiche, the barcode, the parking meter, movie projector, parachute, gas mask, pop top can, space food, and oh yeah, that little thing called the airplane.
Dayton invented the 20th century.
Yes. But now it's like a lot of Midwestern cities.
It's lost more than half its people.
What went wrong?
They still have some things there. They've got good data storage. They're an NCR city. They've found a LexisNexis. They aren't out of it yet. But basically, they're heavy manufacturing. And basically, this is auto parts. And when that boils down to Delphi, which was originally the Dayton Electronics Laboratories Company, Delco. That's what Kettering founded there, and it really built Dayton and its region. They used to have 30,000 jobs there in the Dayton region, Delphi did. And now Delphi hasn't gone bankrupt. Its American branch has declared bankruptcy to get rid of its American workers. And this hits hard in a place like Dayton. I think this, Michael, I want to stress that there's three steps here, and most Midwesterners know them pretty well. The first one was the Rust Belt, when a lot of manufacturing picked up and went to the southern United States, somewhat to get away from unions, cheaper labor, that sort of thing. Then there was, as we all recall, the Japanese challenge of the early 80s, late 70s, where a lot of Japanese companies moved in and simply did better what we had always done. This was the first whiff of international competition. What we got now, and it really is new, is globalization. This isn't Japanese companies moving jobs in anymore. It's American companies that are leading the charge overseas, simply because what we used to do, which was run heavy industry in a great big national market where we could write the rules and enforce the rules, that's broken down. It's globalization now. We're in competition with 3 billion new workers. These are workers mostly from the old communist countries like China and Russia and Eastern Europe or from India that have appeared in our economy really in the past 15, 18 years. This is really new, and it's a brand new era, and to say we haven't come to terms with it is understating.
292-8513, if you'd like to join the discussion here on Open Line. Also, you can email us at openline@wosu.org. You mentioned that manufacturing output here in the Midwest is still very good, but the number of jobs produced by that output obviously has shrunk dramatically. What can we do? I mean, there's nothing we can do to reverse that trend. I mean, efficiency is here to stay.
Yeah, we don't want to get rid of manufacturing. Still brings in a lot of money. The manufacturing the high-end manufacturing, is great, but it's extremely automated, as we know. Factories have had to automate to cut costs to compete with this global competition. So we want to keep the manufacturing. But we have to realize that the manufacturing isn't going to support this area the way it used to, the Midwest. The Midwest is getting particularly hard hit by this because manufacturing was what we did for a living. And we're not going to be able to do that for a living anymore. We still have it, but it's not going to support our people. So then what? Then we really have to start going out and looking for new industries, new ways of doing business. A lot of people are looking at bioscience and biotech, which we ought to be really good at. I mean, bioscience is plant and animal science, and we got the Midwest as anything. It's got lots of plants and lots of animals. But we are losing that race to the two coasts. Nanotech, that's another thing. That's manipulation of subatomic particles to make new materials. Well, materials is what we do for a living also. Down in Dayton, the two universities there are working with some of the old companies to try and see if they can get a nanotech industry going. All this is promising. Nobody knows how promising. Nobody really knows how many jobs these are going to create. So people in the Midwest are floundering around trying to use universities, trying to use new methods of investment to create new jobs without really knowing how this is going to turn out. This is such new stuff, and as far as we can see so far, no magic bullet.
Is it in the genetic makeup of Midwesterners to compete in this new economy of nanotechnology and biosciences and computer technology, or are we still manufacturers at heart?
We're still manufacturers at heart. That business I talked about earlier of, you know, these really good ideas that supported us for 3, 4, 5 generations. I think some of the innovation and competition got bred out of our DNA. We still compete with each other. Each state competes with each other, like our football teams on Saturdays or our basketball teams on Friday nights. We're still fiercely competitive there. The idea of cooperating and collaborating on anything doesn't cross our mind. But really getting into new ideas, innovation, that doesn't seem to hit us. There was an interesting review of my book in a paper in Seattle, of all places, Seattle Post-Intelligencer. The guy liked the book, so I got in touch with him. Turns out he's a native of Columbus, and he and his wife are both Midwesterners and moved out there. And he said the big difference is in the Midwest, if the factory closes, everybody says, whoops, turn out the lights, that's it, life's over, and they go out and, you know, get a job at Walmart stocking shelves. Whereas in Seattle, he says, if a factory closes, if you lose your job, you say, well, that job's gone. Okay, what are we going to do next? Let's find a new job. Let's invent a company. Let's do something new. He says there's resilience and a sense of imagination that the Midwest used to have that still exists in the West Coast and to some degree on the East Coast, but we've lost that. And that's How do you breed it back in? How do you change our DNA?
Why did it just disappear, it seems? I mean, we mentioned all the things that were invented here and the processes and the great manufacturing innovations that took place here in Ohio and around the Midwest. Did it just disappear? Did it move to the coast?
It took a long time. For 60, 70 years there, we really did run things, and we had everything our own way. And the jobs in the factories produced a middle-class way of life. You had guys who carried their lunch in lunch buckets, who worked on the line or on the open hearth, they owned their own home. They had a couple cars. They had a cottage by the lake. They were living the middle-class life. Your granddaddy went to the mill. Your father went to the mill. You were going into the mill, and you expected your kids would, too. And this became a way of thinking. As much in among business people and chambers of commerce as among the unions and workers themselves. We really got very smug. We felt entitled, and to a great degree we still do. We still feel kind of that the world owes us a living. And when the factory in town closes up, as so many factories are closing now, we feel offended. We feel that life has done us a dirty trick. It's going to be hard to get over that. I was up in Michigan, and they were talking up there about a poll that had been taken in Michigan of parents in Michigan. And they found that something like 65% of the parents in Michigan did not see higher education as crucial to their children's future well-being. Not that they were hostile to it. Kid wanted to go to college. It was okay by them. They just really didn't see the point. This is an old-fashioned sort of entitlement way of thinking in an era where, really, if you don't have at least 2 years of college under your belt, you're probably not going to have a decent job as long as you live.
We're talking with Richard Longworth on Open Line on WOSU. Richard Longworth is the author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. The book traces the boom and the bust, so to speak, in the Midwest of the manufacturing industry and what can be done to try to reverse this trend, to reverse the loss of jobs here in the Midwest. 292-8513, if you'd like to take part. I'm Mike Thompson, filling in for Fred Angeli this morning on WOSU. You mentioned education, and that seems to be one thing that just about everybody agrees with, that education is going to be the thing that brings us out of this, that makes us more flexible so we can find another job after one company goes under. Education really is the key, at least the starting point anyway.
It is, which makes it all more startling that here in the Midwest, we are cheaping out our educational system, or more to the point, we're cheaping out these big universities. It's like OSU and the other Big Ten universities and the land-grant universities. These universities still do a terrific amount of research. They still educate an awful lot of kids. They have been, always have been, kind of the centerpiece of our states and the pride of the states. I grew up out in Iowa, and everybody looked to University of Iowa, rooted for the Hawkeyes. That was kind of our identity. That's gone. And the way you can measure how far it's gone is the declining support of states for their state universities. States used to pay more than 50% of the operating costs for universities here in the Midwest. That's dropping now. Most states is down to about 20%. Up in Michigan, the state of Michigan pays only 7% of the operating costs for the University of Michigan. Had a former president of the university up there tell me that his university has gone from being a state-supported school to a state-located school to a state-harassed school. What he meant is the state legislature still tries to keep control and tell the university what to do, but isn't willing to pay for it. And if universities and research and education is the future of the Midwest in this knowledge economy, then we are cheaping out that future. The universities, just to pay the rent, are having to charge higher tuition, as every parent who has a kid in college knows. They are rattling the tin cup for alumni, as every alum knows. And they're going out specially and making contracts with corporations to do research, which just may be the future, the way that universities here support themselves. But in the meantime, universities in the Midwest are going to have to look at new ways to earn money, to earn their keep. And one way of doing that, I feel, is for these universities to stop operating as individual state-based places and start cooperating more. What do I mean by that? Every Big Ten university has, say, a medical school, a law school, a dentistry school, an engineering school, a journalism school, a business school. All of these, they all have these big, expensive graduate schools because that's what big universities do. Now, some of these schools are really good, and some of them aren't so good, but still everybody has one. Where is it written that all 11 Big Ten schools have to have 11, each have 11 of, there has to be 11 of these different grad schools? Can we combine these into about three or four really good world-class grad schools? Now, obviously, this isn't something that's going to happen immediately.
Here in Ohio, the debate is we have a lot of Ohio public universities that have duplicative programs, and it's been mentioned by Governor Strickland and his administration that we should consolidate these programs. But try to tell a university to do away with their law school when, of course, that's where the alumni dollars come from, their graduates and things like that. It's not easy to do.
It is going to be murder to do. One thing I mentioned earlier is this globalization business, which is really, you know, putting the final nail in the coffin of a lot of Midwest economies, is new. This really is, it's younger than today's college freshmen. If the industrial age took a couple hundred years to play out, the global age is going to have the same way. We're really at the start of this, and we're asking a lot of questions now, like what is the role of the university? And where do these schools fit in? What are universities going to have to do? There are no immediate answers, but this pressure is going to grow. I'll tell you another thing that's going. Universities, the Big Ten universities like Ohio State, have a mandate to educate the kids of the state and to promote the economy of the state. And in return, the state pays the bills. Well, as I mentioned, the state has stopped paying the bills. So this is a debate that really hasn't exploded into public yet, but it's going to. Within universities, university people are asking themselves, well, if the state isn't going to pay for us, what do we owe the state? Do we really have to educate those kids? What do we owe to the economy of the state? Is there a better way of doing it? In some schools, they're talking, say, about the Big Ten, the big research universities, no longer educating freshmen and sophomores. Let the smaller schools, and more to the point, let the community colleges take on that chore. That would save the Big Ten schools an awful lot of money. Again, this is just a gleam in people's eye. If something's being talked about, it's not going to happen within the next couple of months. But these are the questions that are being asked. We are in a new time.
Yeah, Ohio State is not doing away with freshmen and sophomores, obviously, but they are.
Not yet, but I bet they're talking about it.
Well, they are encouraging students who perhaps don't have the academic qualifications to be accepted into Ohio State to go to the community colleges, to go to the regional campuses of Ohio State University in some of the cities, you know, an hour or so away from Columbus. 292-85.
Community colleges are going to be big in all this new education. You find a vibrant local economy. You usually find a good community college right at the center of it. It's a much underused and underappreciated asset.
Do you think, you mentioned the lack of desire up in Michigan, the lack of appreciation for the value of a higher education. It's because basically you could make a good living 50
sure.
years ago without even a high school diploma in some cases.
Right.
But as parents realize that their kids are not going to be able to make a good living at the factory like they did, the pressure will grow on politicians to perhaps change the system or at least fund higher education systems.
I definitely think so. That poll I mentioned was taken in Michigan. When I mentioned it to various experts in Ohio and Indiana and the other industrial states, at first, you know, they gasped. And they said, well, you know, if a poll like that was taken in our state, it would come out about the same. Yes, there is going to be pressure on the states to do something about it. But here's the kicker, Mike. We have out there a dying industrial economy. We're still producing a lot. But a lot of these cities, those six of the seven biggest cities in Ohio that I mentioned, are really suffering. And the state government can't be indifferent to this. You have dying old industrial areas. You have declining rural areas. You have big health care costs. You have the need to support these old industrial cities, the Springfields and the Mansfields and the Youngstowns and places like that. All this takes a lot of time and money and focus and energy from the state government. So much so that they're having a very hard time, as you've probably noticed, we certainly have in Illinois, they have a very hard time focusing on the needs of the future, like urban infrastructure or education. Where are they going to get the money? I think when a lot of people are looking at this, they're beginning to realize that looking to the state governments may not be the answer. We've always looked to state governments here in the Midwest, and that probably is ending. Cities are going to have to look out for themselves. Universities are going to have to look out for themselves. There's going to have to be cooperation across state lines. The old auto alley up in southern Michigan and northern Ohio and Indiana, for instance, is one big economic area. There's no reason why that can't act as a multi-state area. Cleveland, you know, is looking up through northeast Ohio and on up to Erie and even down into Pittsburgh to see whether there's a regional future there. Cincinnati looks across the river down into Kentucky. You find this going on all around the Midwest where economic regions are seeing where they can come together without relying on state governments, which in this day and age are probably too small, too otherwise committed, too parochial, really too incompetent to compete and cope in something as big and competitive as a global economy.
It's 11:31. We're going to take a break as we speak with Richard Longworth, author of the book Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. We've laid the groundwork as to what went wrong in the Midwest. We'll look more at ways to fix our economic issues here in the Midwest as we continue on Open Line here on WOSU.
Come on, you know you want it.
It brings those thoughts of your mama being like,
You know you've got to have it.
Free ice cream!
Free!
Ice cream!
Free!
Really? Not a joke?
Well, don't fight the feeling. Come and get it.
I got the feeling.
Get the latest news and a whole lot more.
Baby, baby, I got the feeling.
On NPR's Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in just about 30 minutes, starting at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. It's 81 degrees at 11:32. Your membership with WOSU provides for the news and information you rely on. And in this pivotal election year, your support is more important than ever. Becoming a member is easy when you go online to wosu.org/give. Thank you for your continued support of WOSU 820, NPR News. Don't forget, you can now get all the day's news from All Things Considered and the business news from Marketplace now on WOSU 89.7 FM, weekdays from 4 until 7 o'clock. In the weather forecast for today, sunny skies and a high near 88 degrees. A slight chance of showers, maybe a thunderstorm tonight. Cloudy tonight and a low of 69. There's a good chance of showers and thunderstorms for Tuesday, otherwise mostly cloudy and a high near 89, and then rain likely Tuesday night. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Fred Anderle this morning. With us is Richard Longworth. He is a former Chicago Tribune correspondent, and also he's a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and the author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. Let's go to the phones. 292-8513 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. Let's go to Chuck. You're on the air with Richard Longworth.
Good morning, Richard. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chuck.
Very good show, and I think that the key is education. However, I'm thinking that this has happened innumerable times all over the world since what we call civilization has begun. If you look at history, there were places that are now, like the city of Petra in the Middle East that was an important place, or the Hanseatic League, or all kinds of things like that that could not continue to exist because of externalities. And it appears to me that externalities, including our federal government's foreign policies and many other things, are really impediments to attempting to solve this in an area such as the Midwest. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. Richard, is this different than what other boom and bust towns have faced?
Chuck really has a point. I'm arguing this is different. The globalization is a new wave of the economy, and it replaces, at least certainly in the United States and the other first world countries, it replaces the industrial era, which has gone away and which we kind of ruled. So the era of globalization, yeah, it is new. But on the other hand, Chuck is absolutely right that societies have faced this for centuries, for millennia. My favorite example is a place called Potosi. I don't know how many people, your listeners, know Potosi. Potosi used to be the biggest city in the Western Hemisphere. It was bigger than New York. It was bigger than anywhere else. Potosi is a silver mining town up in the Bolivian Andes. And at one time, it was the Big Apple of the Western Hemisphere because the Spanish really needed that silver. Well, the mine played out. I think Potosi's still there, but nobody's ever heard of it and doesn't amount to anything. All through history, civilizations and cities have risen and fallen. Cities in particular and economic regions are usually created for some economic reason. There's a port. It's a handy place to cross by a bridge. There's a factory. There's a mine there. And as long as this economic reason survives, then the city will survive and thrive. But eventually, this economic purpose of the city goes away. The port silts up, or somebody builds a bridge, or the mine plays out, or railroads go somewhere else. And then these cities and places and civilizations have to recreate themselves. Well, that's what's happening in the Midwest now. Most of the Midwest, Cleveland, Columbus, Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, were all created for some economic reason, and that was industry. We were created to serve the industrial age. That age has gone away, so we got to reinvent ourselves.
One success story that you mentioned is Chicago. They have reinvented themselves to some degree. The meatpacking industry isn't what it once was. Manufacturing obviously isn't what it once was, but that city has turned around and is thriving to some degree. What did they do that can be a lesson to the rest of the Midwest?
We're one of those rare instances where we've morphed from being a big industrial city to being a global city. That is, we are a center of the global economy. Again, a new economic reason for being. And we've done this largely, Mike, by building on the past in an odd sort of way. You mentioned that we had the stockyards. Well, stockyards aren't here anymore. But along with the stockyards went the traders on LaSalle Street, the ones who were trading pork bellies and all that sort of thing. We pretty much invented trading here, commodity trading in Chicago. Well, we don't do much of that anymore, but people here know trading. And using some ideas from the University of Chicago, they pretty much invented the global trading industry, international derivatives, and all those, you know, new financial instruments. And this has kind of planted the seed for the revival of Chicago. We don't have much industry here in Chicago anymore, but we still know industry. We've got a lot of law firms and economists and consultants and accountants who know industry, and your industry may be scattered all over the world as it is now, but if you need advice on how to run it, Chicago is where you go. So this has really revitalized Chicago, or rather I should say it's revitalized part of it. If you come to downtown, the Loop in Chicago and the area around the Loop, this place is booming. It still is leaving behind a great chunk of the Chicago population, especially those who aren't getting education. We have the same sort of dropout rate, pushing on 50% in the inner cities of Chicago, the places like Cleveland has. Globalization so far is being very good for Chicago. It's not always being very good for a lot of Chicagoans. Again, a problem that we haven't begun to solve, but we're going to have to, or else we're building up a huge economic and social and especially human problem for the future, as are so many Ohio City.
I mean, that is the issue, is the human problem, where the stockyards and the mills and the factories would employ thousands of people. There's no way you're going to employ thousands of people if there's – you can't support thousands of lawyers or millions of lawyers in an area or traders or things like that. The workforce is shrinking. The size
Chicago,
of the workforce.
Chicago, as we were talking, is really, really doing very well. Chicago is booming. But still, the number of jobs in Chicago and the number of people in Chicago continues to decline. We haven't had the losses that places like Cleveland and Detroit have. But so far, this new economy, which we are doing very, very well, is still not good enough to support everybody here who wants a job. And, huge concern for the future. You have to ask yourself, what is the purpose of an economy? And you ask, if it's not for the well-being of the people who live within it, then what's the purpose anyhow? Economies exist to support the people who live within them.
292-8513, 292-8513, if you'd like to join in our conversation. Also, we'll take your emails at openline@wosu.org. I'm Mike Thompson, filling in for Fred Angeli this morning. Our guest is Richard Longworth, author of the book Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland and the Age of Globalism. We're talking about the Midwest economy today. Let's go to the phones. And Stella, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I have a few comments to make about some solutions.
Sure.
One solution that I came up with while sitting here listening to him, he is absolutely right. This should be a new revolution in economic empowerment. And I see it in our children. If we don't save them, they don't have jobs to come out to. I work construction. I'm a black female. And I've done all kinds of work in my lifetime, from a painting contractor to a waitress to a car salesman to this and that. And I have a two-year degree in paralegal. Never used it because I stayed in the industrial, you might as well say construction area. As far as the children concerned, I think that we need to go back to our old roots where Grandpa and Grandma used to do, and find a vacant lot and vacant land that the state can't use or the city can't use, and start growing things and teaching our children how to grow them, grow things, and ship it overseas. It could be edible flowers. It could be seeds that we can ship over to other countries that need food, and we'll pay pennies on the dollar. Who knows?
Okay, thanks, Stella. Richard, thoughts on individual entrepreneurial spirits and what people can do on their own?
I thought it was interesting. Stella mentioned several things, that she's been a waitress, she's been in construction, jobs like that. You got people right now trying to figure out what sort of jobs are going to be outsourced. As we know, a lot of factory jobs, line jobs, can be outsourced. A job that can be done somewhere else just about as well and a lot cheaper is being outsourced. And now we're getting into areas where, tax lawyers and various areas of the legal trade, investment bankers, stock brokers, jobs like that, even some journalistic jobs are being outsourced. We really don't know what's there. Probably the ones that are still going to be here are going to be jobs like construction. You can't pound a nail in Columbus if you're in India.
Can't fix a toilet.
Table in Columbus if you're in India. You can't give a haircut to somebody in Columbus if you're in India. There's some things we are not going to outsource. How good of jobs these are going to be, I don't know. The thing to do with education is really to educate our kids with the basics in some things like science, math, no mysteries here, to be able to cope and compete in this new economy. Growing your own food is nice, but this is small scale subsistence farming. It's almost going back to an earlier era of small subsistence farming. Most of the food that's being exported these days is being exported by the giant corporations, the ADMs and the Cargills of the world, who have pretty much a lock on this market. There's some talk actually in Detroit of to the stage of just simply plowing up part of the city and returning it to farmland. But as a means of really supporting the population there on anything more than subsistence level, I'm not optimistic.
Now, Columbus has been labeled recession-proof. We find now that that's not necessarily the case. We have lost manufacturing jobs here. We've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs here, but not nearly as many as percentage-wise as say Cleveland or Detroit has lost. Does Columbus continue to fare fairly well, or even like cities like Columbus with a lot of government jobs, a lot of corporate jobs, a lot of university-based jobs? We have to be mindful of the new economy as well.
Columbus is certainly doing better than other Ohio cities. I mentioned the 6 out of the 7 biggest Ohio cities lost more than half their population. The 7th, the exception there, is certainly Columbus. And yes, all the statistics show that you are doing well. Having a university there is a really good idea, not only because it creates jobs, because it puts you in touch with the rest of the world. So much, we were talking earlier about the flat Midwest and all that. It's not really flat. There are peaks and valleys. Chicago is one of those peaks. You know, we're a global city. You have other places like Columbus. You have university towns like Madison and Ann Arbor that are in touch with the rest of the world, that are part of this global conversation. The problem is that we stand on our mountaintops in Chicago or Columbus or Ann Arbor and talk with Shanghai or Frankfurt or Singapore or Mumbai, and sort of talk over the heads of everybody who's down there in the global valleys, the people in the old manufacturing towns, the people in the rural areas, for whom this conversation is no more than a rumor. Well, this is good for people who live in Columbus, and there's certainly nothing you should do to discourage this. State government is still a powerhouse. You're getting a lot of consulting firms in there. You have your industries. You do a lot of banking. All this is good for the future. If Columbus has a problem, from what I've seen, it may be that this isn't really revitalizing the center of the city as it should. Real global cities like Chicago or New York or London or, you know, Seattle, places like that, have very vibrant centers of the city, whereas Columbus continues to sprawl and sprawl further into the suburbs and exurbs. This creates, of course, a transportation problem. In an era of $4 to gasoline, the costs here become pretty significant. And Columbus probably should concentrate on pulling itself back into the center, becoming denser in the center, because it's this density of smart, educated people that really makes the city competitive in the global era.
$4 a gallon gas, as you mentioned, could very well help with the sprawl problem we have. 292-8513, 292-8513, or open line at WOSU.org if you'd like to email us. Immigration is a big issue. It's been a big issue in the Southwest, mainly in California, and certainly in the Northeast. It's becoming a bigger issue here in the Midwest, where we see more and more immigrants coming in to share our work, both on the sort of low skill level, restaurant workers, construction workers, and on the higher skill level, university researchers and white collar jobs. The immigrants coming from Asia to fill those jobs. That's a thing that the Midwest has been wrestling with. How are we doing?
Some places pretty good. As you say, we need both. We need the PhDs from India and we need the workers from Mexico. In a global era, you simply have to be in touch with the rest of the world, and having people flowing in and out from all over the world is one of the best ways of doing it. When my wife and I came back to Chicago a number of years ago, we've been living overseas. This city, it was the depth of the Rust Belt era. The place was gray, rusty, grim. You really felt, the whole city was kind of sliding downhill into Lake Michigan. And you look at it now, the vibrancy of the city is terrific, and a lot of this is due to immigrants, not only those PhDs, but also the workers who simply are injecting new money, new blood, new life into the city. We have something like 1.5 million Mexicans living in Chicago and the suburbs now, of whom about 40% were born in Mexico. And their impact on the city has simply been terrific. A lot of investment, a lot of home ownership, that sort of thing. With that, of course, goes a lot of problems. Schools, dropout rate is bad. There's a crime problem, health problem, housing problem, all this sort of stuff. So we've got a lot of problems with immigration, but it could be a lot worse. And it could be like Cleveland, where the population there used to be more than 50% foreign-born back in the early 20th century. It's now 4% and falling. And as one civic leader in Cleveland told me, he said, we can't even get illegal immigrants here. Immigrants go where there are jobs. Immigrants are creator of economic vitality, and they are an offshoot of economic vitality. Immigrants go where the jobs are, where there's work to be done, and once there, they create more jobs and more work. You find this in cities that are lucky enough to have them. You find this out in these little old farming towns far away from metro areas, where around the Midwest, almost all of these are dying out, except for areas, agricultural places, or especially meatpacking towns that are drawing in immigrants. A lot of social problems there, a lot of education and health problems go with this, but these are the only towns that are still thriving and possibly have a future.
292-8513, 292-8513, if you'd like to take part in our conversation. Just a few minutes left with Richard Longworth. He's a former Chicago Tribune correspondent and author of the book Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland and the Age of Globalism. We're looking at the economy of the Midwest this hour on Open Line. Alan, you're on the air.
Good morning. I haven't listened to his whole conversation on the radio, but two questions, comments. He made the comment a minute or two ago about Economies are there to support the people. And my thought, isn't that a little communistic or socialistic? And then the second question is, I've read where London has taken over Wall Street as the financial center of the world. I was wondering if you'd comment on that.
The last I've seen the figures, I think there's a good deal of worry in New York about this. There's a terrific competition between London and New York for financial leadership. The fact is that these global markets are growing so fast, some places probably in subprime lending, as we've seen, growing a bit too fast. But there's enough there to go around. Both cities are doing very well. The first point, no, that's not socialistic. It is simply a fact of politics and of human nature. People in this day and age, we've gone past the era of centuries where people just lived in villages, worked the land, the hunter-gatherer sort of economy, the very basic economy. We're into an era now where people want to have a good job, want to have this job support them and their families. They want to feel they're getting ahead. They want to feel their kids are doing better than they did. And they look at an economy and they see whether this is going on or not. In a thriving economy supports well, but gives to the people who work within it, the people put in their labor and get back a decent standard of living, a level of economic decency. If that's not there, then people will look at their economy and say, what's going on? This isn't working. We can't have this economy anymore. It's called capitalism, but it's not working for us.
You need buyers and sellers.
If capitalism isn't working, then let's have some other system. And that's where you get into the political imperative that an economy work for the people who live within it.
Let's go back to the phones. Charles, a comment on immigration.
I'm a little bit disturbed by the fact that your guest seems to think that there's a shortage of good workers in this country. If employers paid a decent wage with decent benefits, the workers are there. Often the immigrants are just used at a substandard wage.
Richard, if they paid more for paid a higher salary for McDonald's workers, you'd have more people working there that are not immigrants, correct?
Yeah, you would in some jobs, certainly in jobs like the meatpacking jobs. Frankly, they've tried that, and they can't get local workers. They have to have the immigrant workers. A lot of the new jobs, say in Chicago, that are being worked by immigrants simply didn't exist a few years ago. You have whole, gardening services, small manufacturing going on. You have things, the basic services, dog walkers, valet parkers, things like this. This is not the basis for an economy, but it is drawing in people who can earn more money here doing jobs that Americans didn't do, probably wouldn't do, never thought of doing. Employers should pay more for all these, and I think the minimum wages certainly can be raised without doing in our economy. But you have to remember also, in a global economy where almost any job that can be done cheaper somewhere else will be, you face this outsourcing problem. We're in competition with very low wages around the world. We can bemoan this. I think we all do. I think this, an American worker who has been earning $25, $30 an hour with benefits on the line, who sees his job going somewhere to places where workers earn $2 a day, has every reason to feel injured and damaged and very hard done by. This isn't the way life was supposed to be. But the fact is, we are into this global economy. We can raise the drawbridge. We can just, cut out, absent ourselves from the global economy. That won't work. So what are we going to do about it? To your caller, to Charles, it is the start of a new era. Nobody has the answer. If somebody comes along and says they have the answer, they don't. All I'm saying is we are in a new era. It's being felt in the Midwest particularly strongly because of our history of agriculture and especially of heavy industry. And this may be the place where the answers are found, but it's early days.
David, you are next on Open Line with Richard Longworth. Go ahead, David.
Yes, Richard, I was just wondering what you thought of the Rickenbacker Intermodal Yard that was a big investment here recently in the Heartland Corridor and what that spelled for Columbus's future.
Richard, are you familiar with what's going on there? It's the former,
Say that again, please.
It's the he's asking a question about the Rickenbacker Air Base south of Columbus here. It's being turned into a transportation hub, an intermodal transportation center, rail, air, and things like that. And it's had a great deal of success. And that's a big push here in Columbus is logistics and transportation because we are essentially located.
Well, I don't know anything about this Rickenbacker yard particularly, Mike, but it sounds like a good deal. Things are going to move. Goods are going to move. Logistics is a big industry. Logistics creates good jobs. There's good warehouse jobs. There's good truck driving jobs. There's a lot of good jobs that come out of this. Transportation in and out of an area. We're all on our computers and internet. We are communicating virtually these days. But the fact is that in this global economy, goods move, people move. Having a strength in transportation is very strong. I think you need good airline service. You need good truck and rail service. And a yard like this, certainly Chicago gets a lot of mileage out of its intermodal yards, and I suspect this one will too.
But their efficiency hurts again as far as the number of workers a transportation hub or a logistics hub can provide because everything's automated and you only need a couple people to run a warehouse a lot of times and things like that.
To a degree, but with all the movement, with the truck driving, with all this sort of thing, again, we don't know what gas prices are going to do to this.
Mm-hmm.
But these transshipment yards in Chicago provide something like 35,000 jobs for the Chicago region. Granted, a bigger region, but still, you know, that's not hay.
Okay, just a couple of minutes left. Richard Longworth, author of the book Caught in the Middle. This is a big issue, and I feel badly we're only going to spend about a minute on it, but water is something the Midwest has going for it with the Great Lakes just to our north.
Has Ohio ratified the Great Lakes Compact yet?
If they haven't, they're close. I think
okay,
they have.
Good. This is the compact that gives the Great Lakes states plus Ontario and Quebec control over Great Lakes water and enables us to control a lot of the diversion from there. There's always been a worry that areas of the country that are drying up are going to and build the longest straw in the world and start sucking from the Great Lakes. This will probably keep this from happening. The Great Lakes is such an asset. 20 years from now, if you want to live somewhere, invest somewhere where there's a reliable source of fresh water, there's only going to be one place to do that, and that's right here. Anything we can do to preserve the Great Lakes and to capitalize on this terrific asset is going to be a very good investment in our future.
Yeah, just go down to the Southwest and Colorado and Arizona and talk to them about their water issues. Even in the Northeast, where water bills are sky high, water is becoming more and more of an issue.
And what can we do to capitalize on it? Up in Wisconsin, they're talking about making that the hub of freshwater industries. What can water be done to how can water and water technology be used to create new industries? They're thinking a lot about this in Milwaukee. They've suddenly realized that that great big lake right next door to them may be the key to their future.
Okay. Our guest this hour has been Richard Longworth. He is the author of the book Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland and the Age of Globalism. Richard, thanks very much for sharing some thoughts about our economy, which is always the number one issue here in the Midwest.
Mike, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My thanks to Amy Jurevich as the controls. This has been Open Line on WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer. In partnership with the Nature Conservancy, Meijer is helping customers identify and select non-invasive plants for Ohio backyards. Information is available.